On your front cover here of the packet, I saw this was in the news this week. There is a new wine on the market. It's not kosher, but it got me thinking. Called the West Loop Red. I'll be honest with you. I'm not sure I know exactly what the West Loop is, but I assume it's someplace downtown. And it's made by City Winery. So it was very nice that they just came out with this week because it's in time for Purim, which is exactly the topic that I wanted to discuss with you today and think about Purim in a specific light that maybe we haven't thought about before. We know that Purim has a lot to do with drinking wine. Not just drinking, but drinking wine specifically. But the concept of drinking wine doesn't, as far as I know, and I'm not a big wine drinker at all. I don't drink wine bichlal, but I was told, and what I understand, and what I see people who drink wine properly, it doesn't just involve your sense of taste. Right? It also involves the olfactory sense. So for that reason, there's a whole story with how you put your nose near the glass. Depending on the size of your nose and the size of the glass, that has its own challenges. But there's a whole thing about smelling the wine and aerating the wine. The wine has to breathe and your nose has to breathe. This is a whole story about wine, but the truth is it's actually not coincidental that this is in the context of Purim, as we can discuss. Just by way of introduction, there is an unbelievable sefer that it's unique in that it's arranged according to the months of the year, and it has a very deep Kabbalistic and Hasidic teachings. It's authored by Reb Tzvi Hirsch, Melech of Dinov, who is essentially one of the precursors to the Munkács dynasty of Hungarian Hasidim. Although I found out recently Munkács now is in Ukraine now. Every 5 minutes, somebody else has Munkács. But Bikaron, they're Hungarian Hasidus. And he quotes from the Ari HaKadosh that every month on the Jewish calendar has a specific part of the person that it corresponds to. And the month of Adar corresponds to the nose. It's interesting. So we have to think about what is the significance of the fact that it corresponds to the nose. Years ago, I was traveling. I gave it to you on pages 1 and 2. You can read it later. Years ago, I was traveling on United, and I came across, I put it in the files, I came across this article called Smellbound. You know the Hemispheres magazine? So they have all kinds of interesting articles, especially if you're in the business of looking for these things. You can find all kinds of interesting things on there. So they had an article about wine and how the aroma of wine is something that distinguishes one wine from a different wine. Now, part of the challenge here is to figure out what the aromas they're talking about. You know, sometimes they write, it has a hint of wet pebbles and gooseberries. I don't know, when was the last time you ate a wet pebble? Right? I don't know what that means. I mean, and gooseberries, and what does it have to do with pebbles and dirt and... But the idea, this is what the reason I brought it for you, is because it develops this notion that wine has something to do with the sense of smell. So the Gemara, let's go to something serious. The Gemara on page 3 gets us really out of the gate. The Gemara has an important statement, which is not clearly understood at first glance. Amar Rava. Rava taught the following. This is the Gemara Megillah on Daf Zayin Amud Beis. Mechayev inish lebesume bipuraya ad delo yada bein oror haman leboruch Mordechai. What does that line mean?
Drink till you don't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman.
Okay, that's one way of reading it. That's
the word spicy in there, right?
Yeah. Besamim. So that there seems to be some interesting layers in this line. The words literally mean mechayev inish libesume, which we generally translate as to become drunk or intoxicated. Libesume. Even though the word bosim Rashi earlier, the Gemara raised the words earlier, bisma, as having to do, bisima, having to do with dessert, something sweet. The Gemara has an expression. I don't know if anybody ever heard this expression, there's always room for dessert. It's actually a Talmudic expression. Ravcha l'bisma shchiach. There's always space for bisma. Bisma is something sweet, like dessert. So there's always room for dessert. It's a good thing if you have a pastry chef in your family, this Gemara is very important. There's always room for dessert. That's what the Gemara says. So the word bisma, bosem, also means besamim, bosem, fragrance. So this, the simple understanding of lebesume, Rashi, if you go to the left, right before the Mishnah, leivsume, Rashi's girsa had an aleph in it, lehishtaker b'yayin, to become intoxicated with wine. Until the point, ad lo yada, until you do not know, you can't distinguish between Ar Haman and Baruch Mordechai. So there's a lot of discussion about this Gemara. First of all, does this Gemara still obtain halacha lemaisa? Because the Gemara later on tells a story of two great sages who were intoxicated and Suda maybe got out of hand. It's hard to know what that story meant. So there's one question, if it's meant to be taken literally, then the question means, even if it's halacha lemaisa, what does it mean, ad lo yada bein Ar Haman l'Baruch Mordechai? Do you have to become so intoxicated that you can't tell the difference? Maybe you can't tell the numerical difference. Maybe if you just take a nap, well, then you also can't tell the difference because you're not awake. So there's a lot of discussion about this Gemara, but one thing that's not often discussed in the context of this Gemara is, why didn't the Gemara just say, mechayev inish le'ishtaker, to become intoxicated? Isn't it interesting?
But this is Aramaic.
Right. So is this the only word? And the fact that this word has a double meaning, what's the significance of the fact that we chose this word? So that's what I want to put on the table. The fact that the Gemara chooses this unusual term for drinking on Purim in the context of the aroma, the smell, I think is significant.
Do they use this term elsewhere?
That's a good question. I wish I knew better. If elsewhere in Shas, the word... I'm not sure. I could do a search. I don't know off the top of my head. I'm trying to remember where else it would come up that someone was inebriated. I don't remember. I would have to check. But in the top of this Gemara, it's used in a different context. The same word is used for three lines earlier, Ravcha l'bisma shchiach. So it's a hard word to pin down a little bit. So this is the first reference. But now if you look on the next Gemara, page 4, the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Kuflam et Tesemet Beis, tells us the following. Esther min ha-Torah minayin. Where does Esther appear in the Torah? So how would you answer that question?
She does.
She doesn't. Why doesn't Esther appear in the Torah?
She didn't
say. Right. So what's the Gemara asking?
Where's some hint to Esther?
Okay, so why would the Gemara ask that question? Why would the Gemara want to know where you find a hint to Esther in the Chumash? Why is that significant?
Because everything's in the Torah.
Right. And so why are we supposed to discover that?
Help validate the story.
Okay, maybe to help validate the story.
Over there, we'll give an insight into how exactly. It's going on over here.
Exactly. We're supposed to be the Sherlock Holmes. We're supposed to understand a message. There's supposed to be, I think, what Paul is saying, I think, is there's an encoded message here that Chazal trying to teach us. So there is the element of foreshadowing, but there's also the element of, the Gemara is asking the question because they want to teach us a lesson. It's like so many things in the Medrash, where the Medrash says, let me tell you a story about such and such. And you wonder, why is the Medrash telling us the story? The answer is because it wants you to learn something from that story and apply it to the context that you're dealing with. So here's the Gemara asked the question, where do you see Esther in the Chumash? So obviously this is, like, to me, that's an immediate red flag that says, okay, pay close attention, because there's obviously something that's going to be taught here. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you. Va'anochi haster astir. That is a pasuk in the end of Sefer Devarim, when the Jewish people are told, we're not going to listen to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and we're going to get very severely punished. And how is that punishment going to be manifest? I will be haster astir. I will hide my face, and I will reinforce that hiding. Haster, astir. So how does that relate to the story of Purim? Okay, the hidden role of God. What are we going to say? Yes, exactly. So that's exactly the Gemara's point, to tell you that the name Esther is bespeaking this idea that it's hidden and God's role is hidden. Nowhere in the Megillah does the name of the Ribono Shel Olam appear. Right? God's name does not appear anywhere in all the chapters in the Megillah.
Not directly, but all kinds of things.
Where will you find it?
The ends of words.
It's hidden.
So it is? It's hidden. It's hidden. You have to find it. Many understand, as many traditions, just about the difference between when the Megillah says Hamelech and Hamelech HaChashverosh. Very often, I don't want to say every single time, because you would have to do a careful analysis, when the Megillah says Hamelech, it refers to Hamelech with a capital H. Hamelech, very often. So they say traditionally, Nodadoshnas Hamelech, who couldn't sleep? Not Achashverosh couldn't sleep. The Ribono Shel Olam Kivyachol couldn't sleep. Not Loyon V'Loyishan, the Ribono Shel Olam never sleeps. But the idea that it was Esther appears before the Melech. So there are a lot of references, but it's hidden. Okay, so that's one. Mordechai min HaTorah Minayin. Where do you find Mordechai? Says the Gemara, Mor Dror. Mor Dror, next week's Parsha. Mor Dror. Where's Mor Dror? I know what Mor Dror is.
Spice.
That's right. It's a spice. It comes in the Pitam HaKetores. It's one of the spices in the incense in the Ketores. Uma Targuminon, and the Targum, meaning the Aramaic tradition, is Mira Dachya. And if you put Mira Dachya together, what do you get?
Mordechai.
Interesting. So why is Mordechai one of the spices from the Ketores? Just parenthetically, I'll give you just one extra little vort, because you came this morning, you get a bonus.
But it's by way of Aramaic.
Yes, but the Gemara says that's the hidden meaning. Just because you came this morning, you get a bonus vort. Great vort. You ready? But it's not part of the shir, just extra. It's not in the underline because it's not part of the shir. But the Haman, the Gemara says, Haman min hator minayin. How do you know about Haman? So the Gemara says, Hamin ha'etz. From the tree. Right, so the word Hamin, hey, Memnun, is the same letters as Haman. Very cute, right? It's nice. It's good for like first graders. So what's the Gemara trying to tell you? This is a great word. So I don't remember who said this. Like old Darshanim used to say this. Adam Arishon, he had every single tree in the whole garden. What was the problem? One tree couldn't eat. One tree he couldn't eat, and it drove him crazy to the point where he ate from the tree. There's one man who wouldn't bow. Haman had every single other servant in the whole kingdom would bow to him except for one guy, and it drove him crazy. Hamin ha'etz. So that's what people say, Darshanim say, but that's what you learn from Hamin ha'etz. Just because you can't have everything, so for some people it means you have nothing. Right? Kol ze inenu shovali. It's nothing to me, Haman says, because there's one guy. Adam Rishon and all the trees. Anyway, worth coming for that? A nice bonus. Okay, back to the story. Let's go to page 5. So here's the question. What was Esther's real name?
Hadassah.
Vayhi omenes Hadassah, says the Gemara on your Gimel and Aleph. Kari la es Hadassah v'kari la Esther. We call her Hadassah and we call her Esther. Tanya, we have a Braisa. Rabbi Meir Omer, Esther Shema. Her name was really Esther. Veloma nikra shma Hadassah. Why was she called Hadassah? Al shem hatzadikim, based off of the righteous people, shenikra'u hadassim. They are called hadassim. V'chein hu omer v'hu omeid bein ha-hadassim. So isn't that interesting? Either her name was Hadassah, or according to Rabbi Meir, her name was Esther, but everybody called her Hadassah. What are Hadassim?
Myrtle.
Mm-hmm. Bingo. Right? Of all the four species, The one that's primarily, sometimes you go to the Kotel, you have people running around looking for someone who wants to make a bracha, Bor Mene Besamim. What do they have there usually, very often, I remember? They have Hadassim. Mm-hmm. Some people use that for Havdalah. They use Hadassim. And the Medrash describes about the Dalag Minim that what's unique about the Hadas is that it doesn't have any Tam, but it has Reach. So now we have one more reference to the sense of smell in the story of the Megillah. So let's turn the page. So this is a sefer called Yohel Or. I'll show you the Sharblat. This is the Sharblat of the sefer. It's an old sefer that I was able to get through Otzer HaChachma. It is Kabbalistic teachings of the Vilna Gaon. So already it's like the deep end of the pool. You see, it was published in Vilna by the brothers Ram. The brothers Ram are a famous publishing house because they were the first ones to publish the modern printed version of the Talmud. They were famous publishing house. They published the what we call the Vilna Shas. The Vilna Shas was published by these brothers Ram. You see where it says, Hotzos Ha'almana, the widow, the Ha'achim Ram, and the brothers Ram. So they were the same publishers who made the famous Vilna Shas with the pagination that we know. They also published this sefer called Yohel Or, the Glory of the Light, also called Hadras Kodesh, which includes explanation on the Zohar by the Vilna Gaon. So someone tracked this down. I don't read Yohel Or. I don't even know what it says in the Yohel Or. If I tried, I probably wouldn't understand anything that it says. But there's one little piece here that it says that many quote, but now you'll see it inside. It's on page 6. It says the Yohel Or, Inyan Purim, Shehu Keneged, Yuk Shehu Neged Yom HaKippurim. Interesting. He says that Purim, according to the Kabbalah, according to the Zohar, is opposite Yom Kippur. Notice how the word, the title of that day, of that holy day, is Yom Ha Kippurim, the full title. What's that? Exactly, it's Kippurim. So this is what he develops on the idea. Go to the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth line down. Rak, the first word on the lower line is rak. Rak be Yom HaKippurim. Only on Yom HaKippurim, she'ein bo achila ushasiya, that doesn't have any eating or drinking, negdo purim. It has the opposite as Purim, which has v'lachein bo harbe mishte. You have a lot of eating and drinking on Purim. You have a special Suda. And he says, Ke'en lacha yom tov b'Yisrael k'yom HaKippurim. There's no holiday like Yom HaKippurim. V'erev Yom HaKippurim and Erev Yom HaKippurim b'shvil simcha shel HaKippurim. And for that, all of that we'll explain in a minute. He goes on. So, this is already getting to a much deeper level, that Yom Kippur has something to do with Purim, and that while Yom Kippur doesn't have eating, Purim does have eating, and so to speak, they combine to make one whole. So number one, what does smelling have to do with Purim? And number two, in what way, what is the meaning, what is the significance of this deep Kabbalistic teaching, this tradition, that Yom Kippur and Purim have something to do with each other? So he continues here in the Gaon, and he references the Gemara on page 7, which is the following. You know what they have to do with each other? I'll tell you. This is Gemara in Tanis Choptes Mevi'is. Om Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel. Lo hayu yamim tovim li Yisrael kechamisha asar ba'av uchayom HaKippurim. There were no happy days in the Jewish calendar as happy as Yom Kippur and Tu Ba'av. Where I put the little bracket on the bottom. Why? Bishloma Yom HaKippurim, I understand Yom Kippur. Why? De'is bei slicha u'mechila, it has forgiveness. Yom shenitnu bo luchos ha'acharonos. It is the day on which the second luchos were given. So Rashi here on the side, we're not going to go into it inside, Rashi goes through the whole long calculation to run the dates on the calendar that Moshe Rabbeinu, when did he go up to Maimon Har Sinai? When did he come down and break the luchos? He broke them on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, right? That's one of the reasons we have the fast day. Then he went back up to get atonement. Then he had another 40 days for getting the second luchos. When did he come down with the second luchos? He came down with the second luchos on Yom Kippur. Says the Gemara on page 8, this is what the Gemara is referring to. In the bracket in the middle, Vayisyatzvu Besach Tisahar, the Gemara in Shabbos Pechesim and Aleph, that the Jewish people, when describing Maimon Har Sinai, that they stood Besach Tisahar. What do the words Besach Tisahar mean?
Underneath the mountain.
How could they stand under the mountain? That's right. So this is the famous Talmudic statement. You're looking at it in front of you. Amar Rav Dimi Bar Chama Bar Chasa. Rav Dimi Bar Chama, the name of the son of Chasa, said, Malamed, it teaches us, Shakofa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleim Es Hahar Kegigis. That God tipped the mountain over their heads like a barrel. And what did he say? V'amar Lahem, he said to them, Imatem Mekablam HaTorah, if you take the Torah, okay, fine. Mutav, it's good. Ve'imlav, and if not, Sham Tehe Kfuraschem. There you will be buried. It's a Chicago-style offer, right? You have a choice. You want to take it or not. So now the Gemara says, no, this is a problem. Amar Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said, Mikan, from this, Moda'a Rabba La'oraisa. There is a complaint against the Torah. What do you mean we took the Torah? We didn't take the Torah. What happened to us? We got coerced into it. How can you say we accepted the Torah at Sinai and we have a covenant with God? Yeah, what kind of a covenant was that? That wasn't a covenant. So the Gemara says it's a modah. You know what a modah is? Modah is actually a legal term in Choshen Mishpat for a forced sale. What's that?
Under duress.
Exactly. So if I come to you with a gun and say, can you sell me your house, please? You can write what's called a shtar moda'a. You get two witnesses to come and say, I'm writing the sale of my house only because he came to me with a gun. They write the shtar moda'a, then you write the shtar. Then you come to the FBI and you say to the FBI, I just sold my house, but I sold my house because the guy came to me with a gun. And the court will say, oh, what are you talking about? We don't know anything about a gun. And you'll say, no, I have a shtar modah. So the Gemara says, I have a modah. How can you tell me we accepted the Torah? You forced us to take the Torah. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you the truth. You're right. Omar Rava Afal Pike, nonetheless, Hodar Kiblua Bimei Achashverosh. They re-accepted the Torah in the days of Achashverosh. As it says in the Pasuk, Kimu v'kiblu, they accepted, well, they established and they accepted, HaYehudim, the Jews, Kimu, they established, Masha kiblu kvar.
What percentage of Jews lived in Shushan?
I don't know.
This doesn't sound convincing to me.
Which aspect?
That the Shushan Jews could accept
it for everyone.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure, much beyond Shushan, because the impact of the Gezerah of Purim was through all 127 provinces. It wasn't just in Shushan. So everybody was, it happens to be that in Shushan it was I would say, more manifest, because they had extra time, but there's no question that the Gezerah applied to everybody. That's why
it was... The question is, what percentage of the Jewish population lived in...
In the other place. Oh, versus, in Persia?
Versus the rest of the world at that time.
So I would say like this. It had been already decades since the exile. So the the substantial majority of Jews were living in Bavel, which at that time was under the Persian Empire. So you're talking about the majority of Jews were living in that immediate area. There were Jews who were still living in Israel. So soon, Ezra is going to come and try to encourage Jews to come in Aliyah and help the,
which
you know,
most people did not.
If
they accepted the Torah, there's a question.
Oh, so this is another question, which is, oh, we all accepted the Torah, and yet look where we're sitting right now. So that's a good question. Why we're not living in Israel? So maybe some of them had good reasons. Maybe some of us have good reasons, we hope. But but the principle of the matter is the Gemara interprets the story of Purim as a Kabbalah Satorah. That's how the Gemara reflects on it. So now, first of all, you will say, wait a second, didn't we say Nasav and Ishmael Har Sinai? So Tosus deals with that question. And what does it mean that they reaccepted the Torah? So probably what that has to do with the fact that there was, you could see from right off the bat that there was a significant amount of assimilation that was taking place in the time of the Purim story.
Nasav and Ishmael, couldn't you explain that they said that with the mountain over their head too?
So it's possible, but the impression that you get from Nasav and Ishmael, the Gemara tells a story. The Gemara says that when they said Nasav and Ishmael, angels came down with crowns, and everyone got two crowns, and then unfortunately when they did the Chet HaEgel, the angels came back, and they took them away. So you wouldn't get a crown, you don't get this gold star, if you said something under duress. They said Nasav and Ishmael willingly. So Tosfos says, how could you tell me? So there are different components, different answers. And obviously the Purim story has a lot of different layers also, but the fact that there was assimilation initially, and then there was this rededication, so that's very fine and good. But, coming back to the main story, now you understand, says the Vilna Gaon, the connection between Purim and Yom Kippurim, is that they both had Matan Torah, but it's more than that. Take a look on page 9, in the Yalkut Shimoni. You ready for this? What's that?
I said, are we ready? I said, we'll try.
Okay, good. Says the Yalkut Shimoni in Shir HaShirim on the Pasuk V'yodai Matvumor. B'matan Torah. At Matan Torah, what happened? Nismale kol ha'olam kulo besamim. There was a fragrance that filled the whole world on Matan Torah. So the idea of the fragrance is back again. Now it's apparent at Matan Torah. It's also apparent at Yom Kippur. There are some, at the minute, when I was growing up in our shtiebel, there used to be guys who went around with... That's right. You had that growing up? The people, they have besamim, they give out...
On Yom Kippur.
Made you nauseous. But many people, they had the minhag to say Borim and Ebesamim. All right, that was the minhag, but the minhag is Bahari Kodesh. So now you see also on Yom Kippur, there's an element of the smell. So the secret perhaps lies in the essence of the day, which is alluded to in a Gemara, in a totally different context in Megillah, excuse me, in Brachos, on Daf Mem Gimel Malamud Beis. Says the Gemara. The Gemara says, how do we know that you're supposed to make a bracha? Amrav Zutra Bar Tuvia Amrav Minayin Shemavorchin. How do you know you make a bracha? Al Hareach. On a fragrance. Now, this is a big complicated sugya in halacha. What kind of fragrances? You don't make it on, let's say, air freshener. You make it on besamim, different aspects of besamim. What if you transform it into perfume? If it gets ground down? A lot of different discussions. But what's the core? Shenemar, as it says, Kol Hanishama Tahalelka, all of the souls, all of the soul will praise Hashem. That we say in the davening from Tehillim. Ezehu Davar, what is the thing? Shahanishama Nehenes Mimenu, that the soul benefits from it. Ve'ein Haguf Nehene Mimenu, and the body does not benefit from it. Have Omer, that's what you say. Ze Hareach. That is the sense of smell. What is the least tactile sense of a person? It's the sense of smell. Because even, let's say, the sense of hearing, if you ask an audiologist, they will tell you that the sound waves enter the person's ear, and they actually bang against the ear, and they cause the membrane in the ear to vibrate, and those the rate at which the membrane vibrates causes the messages to be sent as to how to interpret the sound.
What about vision?
Vision, also you have to ask the...
I would think that there's probably more stuff going on in your nose than in your eye physically.
So I'm not sure about that. The way it works in your nose, as far as I understand, is that there are tiny, tiny, minuscule particles that are caught by receptors, as opposed to when you have a sense of vision. A, you have cones and rods that interpret the information, but it's more than that. You are engaged in something that you see. You have a connection that is built through the sense of sight, more so than the sense of smell. The sense of sight, a person grasps the reality of something much more clearly when they have a sense of sight. It's something that's concrete. A person, you know, we all find that we are captivated by a sense of sight, but there's something about a sense of smell that's very ethereal. It's very hard to pin down.
Because the human sense of smell is not as developed as we rely on our vision.
Oh, okay. So what does it mean? Is it just... it just happens to be that the human sense of smell is not so developed? Or is that there's something about the sense of smell that the Gemara is saying is that it's less physical than other senses? So there is a tradition that goes back from the mystical traditions that says, look at the story of Adam HaRishon. What happens to Adam HaRishon in the garden with the Chet Eitz Hadas? What happens to him and her? They listen to the Nachash. They see the tree, that it looks good. They take from the fruit and they eat it. Not my kids. What do they not do?
Smell.
That's right. They don't smell it. The element, the sense of smell, according to the holy sources, was never diminished through the Chet Eitz Hadas. It maintains its original pristine quality that you don't have with any of the other senses that were diminished by participating in the Chet HaKadmon, in the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. When the Jewish people came to Matan Torah, we have a tradition that their spiritual state was so elevated, they went back to as the good old days, as it was before the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. So how was that manifested at Har Sinai? Everything was, what's that? Exactly. That sense of smell, that neshama, was manifest through this besamim that exists in the world. What happens on Motsoi Shabbos when we feel that our neshama yisera, that little extra spark of the soul, isn't here anymore? What's going to make us feel better? What do?
Besamim.
That's right. You take besamim on Motsoi Shabbos. That's exactly the reason.
Is there a connection between in the first parsha with God breathing into the nostrils of man?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That source, Vayipach Ba'apav, was never diminished. So we now are starting to understand the significance of this whole idea of the sense of smell. That's why Motsoi Shabbos, you have the besamim, because you feel that your neshama gets a little bit of a lift with the besamim. That's based on this whole idea in this Gemara. So now we can put everything together. When was it that we received the luchos? It was on Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur is the day that we go back, that we can return to that nice, that good place, that reality that we were at before the Chet of the Eitz Hadas, before the Chet of the Ego. Every year, all of us on Yom Kippur, we go back to that same thing. So we're going back, we're tapping into our neshama in this very powerful way. So what's happening on Purim now? And this is mamash, a very deep idea, and it's developed... it's developed. I didn't put it into the packets. It's developed initially by this Bnei Yisachar. Purim is the same concept. Purim is such a spiritually powerful time that we are able, through the experience of Purim, to go back to that time that is alluding to on the secret level, on this mystical level, going back to the sense of smell, to the chush hareach, to Yom Kippur. But it's not just Yom Kippur, it's even more. How is it even more? Because it's Yom HaKippurim. It's Kippurim. Purim is greater. How is Purim greater? So if you look on the next page, Rav Kook, this is quoted. There is a beautiful biography. I wonder if some of you may have even heard of him. Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria. Rav Neria was a chief disciple of Rav Kook, one of the founders of the Bnei Akiva movement and the Mizrahi movement. What's that?
Chaim's grandfather.
Yes. Some of you know his grandson was here for a while in Chicago. So Rav Neria wrote several, there's mamas, the sweetest, sweet biographical sketches of Rav Kook according to different themes. So this is called Mo'adei HaRe'iyah, which is a biographical sketch of Rav Kook according to the holidays and the calendar. And each calendar section has a little vignette and a little Dvar Torah, and it describes the life of Rav Kook during that time. And it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful. So in this section about Purim, so first of all, he talks about what it was like being at Rav Kook's Purim table. It's just an amazing thing. And stories of people who were there and his recollections. Anyway, so he describes, look in a little section Beis where he quotes here, he collects some different places. This is from Ola Sariya, which is Rav Kook's commentary on the Siddur. Lu'um, where I put the Beis with the circle or the star. Lu'umas Yom HaKippurim, as opposed to Yom Kippur, She'ein bo achila ushasiya, that doesn't have eating and drinking, gavoa hi, it is higher, verama, and more noble, ha'achila de kedusha shel sudas Purim. The eating and the drinking of the meal of Purim, it's higher. Vahashta, and now, vahashsiya, and the drinking, shenitztavino alav bimyuchad, that we were specifically commanded, hachiyuv libesume bepuraya, the obligation to become intoxicated, yesh bo me'ein reach bisum sholmaila. It has the besumim, the fragrance of Hashem, of the spiritual qualities, ho'amura bidargos of shel Moshiach. The spark of the ultimate redemption of the Mashiach is hidden in Purim and in Yom Kippur. But Purim is higher. Because it's one thing to live in the world and to reject everything that's physical. That's a high level. You know what's even higher level? To take everything that's around you and to elevate it. Wasn't that unfortunately what happened with Adam HaRishon? That it took something that was in the world and instead of elevating it, he broke it. So we go back to the sense of smell, to the reach, and we bring it up. We bring it up, and that is essentially all the Marishon saw from one end of the world to the other. He saw the Mashiach. That sense of smell. And it's on a high level. It's so difficult to reach this on Purim, but this is probably what Chazal meant when they said that a person should be so inebriated that they should be Adalo Yoda Bein Aror Haman LeBaruch Mordechai. It's that their true essence should come out. And the true essence is one that is fragrant. That's their neshama, that's their soul. And it's a concern, you know, I don't know if my true essence is ready for that yet. Have I really fixed myself? Have I elevated myself to that level? I don't know. But just tapping into the spirit of Purim, that's what their idea was. The idea was that through the drinking, a person's neshama will come forth. There, it'll shine out that it's beautiful. Now, unfortunately, in practice, that's not always the case. Sometimes other things come out when people overdo it on Purim. And that's not necessarily the reach, but that's the goal. And that's Rav Kook writes later, and I put in a little gimel, I'm not going to do Aleph, we're running out of time. But Purim here in the little gimel, Ein hagashmius misnagedes l'ruchanius. On Purim, the physical enjoyment doesn't contradict the spiritual. Hatam apnimi, the inside This is from a different writing from Rav Kook. The inner meaning, she'isr malacha lo kibbal Yisrael al atzma b'Purim. Why is it that you're allowed to work on Purim? You're allowed to drive. You're not supposed to go to work on Purim, ideally. But you're allowed to drive on Purim. You're allowed to write. Why? The Jewish people did not accept it as a strict Yom Tov. He says, I'll tell you why. Ki b'chol Yom Tov, tam isr malacha. The reason why in every Yom Tov you don't work, ho v'ayom u'mikra kodesh. Because the day is a mikra kodesh, it's a sanctified day. Ubiikar atachlis ilisanag al Hashem is to rejoice being with God, and you can't be involved in your daily tasks. However, masha ein kim bapurim, then as ein hagashmius misnageres leruchnius, then a person's neshama is supposed to shine so much that it doesn't collide with his physical mundane activities; it just shines right through it. That is the essence of the day. Va'afilu kisha adam osuk b'malacha motzi sham es or hakadusha. Why ki gadol or hamakif umagula ayideh hamagila? We are surrounded by the light of Hashem. It's or hamakif. This idea of or hamakif, this is alluded to in one of the teachings of the Holy Pius Setzner. In the ghetto in Purim in 1942, he was telling the Jews, you should know that on Purim we had a Yeshua, we don't have time to talk about it today, called the Or HaMakif. We're surrounded by the salvation, the hug of Hashem Yisbarach. So that hug, because it was this overwhelming, enveloping salvation, exists forever. And that hopefully one day we're going to see not just a small Yeshua, a big Yeshua. This is what he was telling them, Purim 1942 in the ghetto. Unbelievable. This idea of this is a deep teaching in Kabbalah of Or HaMakif. Obviously, I don't understand it. But this idea that the person's neshama really comes out, now I can understand one more connection. Do you notice? I heard this idea in a shiur from Rav Moshe Tzvi Weinberg, who's one of the rabbeim in YU, one of the young rabbeim who has, I think he has a little shul in Teaneck. So he was talking about, I forget who he quoted, I think from Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, that's why we refer to this connection between Purim and Yom Kippur, that it's the Itzumo Shel Yom. It's the essence of the day. It's the neshama of the day. The avoda of Yom HaKippurim is to really drill down to who we are. So the avoda, the job, the spiritual goal that we have for ourselves on Purim is to drill down and let that shine. You know, on Yom Kippur, it's so intense and it's so almost reclusive, our avodah, that's within ourselves. No one else should listen to me. No one else can hear. That's why when they come to do vidui, you bow down, you have to... The Bartanura says there was a miracle in the Beis HaMikdash that when they bowed, there was space. Why? So no one else should hear. No one else should intrude on my private space in speaking to the Rabbonu Shalom. So I don't share that. It's very personal, the experience in Yom Kippur.
The opposite in Purim.
Exactly.
You have to share.
Bingo.
You have to share with your family, your friends, and the poor.
Exactly. And you're sharing your essence, you're giving. That's exactly it. It goes back, mamash, to the beginning of the world. Yes.
I mean, in the basic level, the essence of Purim is, you know, yesterday we're supposed to remember Amalek, we never forget. But at the same, I mean, Amalek represents, you know, the gematrias of the Suffolk. Removed out in Purim, in order to remove doubt, we kind of have to have this, you know, this idea of the Asher Lo Yada, so to speak, and the concept of the costumes. Because in order to really let your doubt down, we all have doubt, I think, to some degree, we're, you know, always, you know, we have to have more belief in God. I think that's what we're all trying to strive for. But in order to accomplish that, you got to let your guard down. So you put on a costume, you drink a little bit, and I mean, I'm oversimplifying, I'm not making fun, but to make that connection, it kind of flows into that.
100%. That's exactly the idea. It even sends the message, wait a second, when I dress up as in a costume, it's manifesting the fact that, wait a second, all year round I really am wearing a costume.
Right.
And I wear the costume to actually free myself up, to be myself. Don't worry. Don't look at the outside. That's why, according to the mystical tradition, the person is the soul and the body is just a levush. It's just a costume. It's a costume and it comes and it changes. And you know. But it's really the power, the spiritual power of Purim is so great that we let that out and we share it with other people. And we share how the neshama, the beautiful inside that we have, that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us, that sense of smell, that's going to carry the day, even through the gashmius, even through the physical, eating and drinking, and giving to other people, and driving and all that. So now we go back and we understand why Purim and Yom Kippur have so much to do with each other, and why, according to Rav Kook, it's Yom Kippur is not as high as Purim, because Purim, you're letting that shine with others. It's not just for yourself. You're letting your neshama. We understand now all these interesting references to smell. Lebesumi said Rav Kook, but also Mordechai, Mordachia, Hadassah. It's all about the idea that we need to come back to ourselves, to our true selves, the self that was never diminished. Even by Adam Arishon was never diminished. It's that sense of smell. So our avoda, our tefillah, this Purim, Mirtz Hashem, Abba Aleinu Latova, is that we really should be able to just... That's it. Just inhale the whole yantif. Inhale the whole day of that feeling of being connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam on that deep level that was never nifgam, and we should merit to Orav Asimcha V'Sason and Yikar. Yashikar.